Hey, everybody. It's time for another edition of the Android Central Podcast, episode 302. We're on our way to 400 already. I am Andrew Martinick, and I'm taking over the hosting duties this week. But I'm thankfully joined by other insightful, lovely gentlemen as well. I have Alex Dobie in the UK.
Thanks for that awesome introduction. I'm both insightful and a gentleman, so accurate as well as...
I'm glad you agree with my assessment of you.
Thanks for the accurate assessment there.
I also have Jerry over
who
on the East
the
Coast.
Lovely part. Alex may be an articulate gentleman, but I'm just lovely.
Okay, and let's see what Daniel thinks of himself and what my assessment of him is.
I was very happy with it. It's better than the swearing one where we all called ourselves a bunch of stuff and then we got a bunch of complaints. So
wow, really?
Did we get a bunch of complaints?
Yeah, we got a bunch of complaints. So I'm impressed that we're starting on such an even keel this week.
They were just disappointed we weren't swearing in video.
True. Oh, I think they would be okay with it.
Let's see. So we made it a minute into the recording before mentioning a video podcast, which we are not currently recording. So I appreciate that, Alex.
That's good. I aim to bring that kind of antipathy to every single podcast that I'm involved in.
If we were running video, I would point the camera at the tractor.
Apologies in advance. We're going to try to knock it out a little bit, but Jerry's neighbor is a tractor kind of guy, so he's running a tractor currently.
That's how we roll. Tractor.
because there's no video, people don't know that it isn't just his washing machine.
Yeah.
It'd be way cooler if we could point a camera out the window and show a tractor, but people can go and find pictures of tractors in other places.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll still be going at it. After we're done recording, Jerry can stick his phone out the window and get the, you know, up close and personal version. But this is not the tractor podcast, unfortunately. We do actually have real Android news, mobile stuff happening. And I think the biggest thing that's right at the top of our minds immediately is the Honor 8 launch in the US that I was at the launch event for, and Daniel actually got to use the phone more than I have. I'm actually reaching over as I talk here to grab mine out of its box because I started setting it up yesterday. So, but I think the nice thing is that Alex has probably more of a feel for this phone, even though he hasn't used it because he's been using a lot of recent Honor and Huawei phones. So Daniel, why don't you bring us up to speed just off the start? Like, what's the high level view of the Honor 8?
Well, I reached out to Alex before I got the phone and said, tell me everything you know about Honor.
And he said, okay. I was like, screw you, Daniel. I'm on my way to Amsterdam. I don't have time to talk now.
Then you told me, because you're a gentleman, you told me.
Of course I did, yeah. Yeah.
A few things.
So, and go ahead. I'll let you do the...
I read your Honor 7 review. I read Richard's Honor 6 review, and I realized that the Honor brand is really new. It's a very young company. It's a brand built out of Huawei, which is increasingly trying to make a name for itself in the hardware space in the West, but obviously has a hard time doing so because of the, I'll use the word again, antipathy against the company's network solutions as it relates to the Chinese government. There have been accusations that they are spying on behalf of the Chinese government, that a lot of the executives have ties to the Chinese government. So it's understandable. Being in Canada, I have had I've had a lot of opportunity to use lower-end Huawei phones because they do offer handsets under the Huawei name here. And they actually released the Honor 5X as a Huawei device in Canada, but it was just a bad phone, so nobody really cared.
It was a bad phone in the U.S. too, so
exactly.
It's not just exclusive to you guys.
Yeah.
So I read the Honor... go ahead.
<Oop. laughs> Go on, Jerry. We'll let you go.
I was just going to say, we should be hating on Huawei because their software sucks, not because they're a Chinese company.
Well,
constructive.
Yeah, well, there's the software thing. The other thing is, Huawei as a brand, in terms of their marketing, it hasn't... especially in the past, not so much this year, but that the marketing hasn't necessarily been great. There's also the fact that the name itself is hard to, you look at it, if you're outside this industry, you don't necessarily know how to pronounce it.
Or it's in not, this industry, for God's sake.
Yeah. I mean, even people in this industry in China disagree on how to pronounce it, so there's that. But yeah, the other thing is, up until now, the software has been tailored mainly to taste of people in China or other parts of Asia. That's less the case now with the newest version of it. A lot of the more annoying things have started to go away. In the next version, that'll be improved upon further. But we are, at least, I think, in 4.1, EMUI 4.1 now, we're in a pretty nice place where some of the most objectionable stuff is gone, and that makes a huge difference to the usability of it.
Yeah, I think we can impugn their software to some extent. And after using the Note 7, I've been using the Moto Z for a while. I do think that there are still a lot of things Huawei and Honor need to improve about the phone's UX. But overall, this is a really nice device. It's also the first phone to use the Kirin chipset in the US. And Alex, you wrote a really interesting and really good article about this yesterday about why that's such a big deal. Because, you know, we hear about Qualcomm basically owning the SoC space in the US. Samsung has a bit of a footprint with its 2015 Android phones, but they went back to Qualcomm in 2016. So having another player in the space also making its own baseband chips and finally getting certified to use those baseband chips in the US, that's a really big deal, right?
It's a big deal in that it lets Huawei be more vertically integrated, which means it's not tied to Qualcomm's roadmap when it releases phones and when it releases Honor phones as well in the US. I wouldn't view this as kind of like a MediaTek-style competitor where Huawei's going to be going around selling these to other manufacturers. It's probably not going to happen. We're looking at them in the same way that Samsung has, putting their own stuff in their own phones, and that allows them to be more differentiated. It allows them, of course, greater control. And, you know, if you're not relying on Qualcomm's roadmap and what Qualcomm happens to have at the time, and also buying chips at the same price as everyone else who buys a Qualcomm chip, then it's so much easier to hit a competitive price point like they are with the Honor 8 at $399 in the US.
And the Huawei is one of the few big companies that could actually produce themselves pretty much everything that they need for these phones. Of course, you know, Apple has been buying up more and more. Samsung can pretty much build everything. LG is pretty darn close as well.
There's still a lot of Samsung in all of these phones, I believe. I mean, of course, the...
A lot of the memory.
Actually, I'm getting my Huawei phones mixed up. The Huawei P9 Plus, which I have in front of me, uses an AMOLED screen, which is from Samsung. The Honor, I believe, has an IPS screen. But Huawei still is in a position where it makes the screens and the memory chips and the flash inside. There's still a lot of sourcing of other parts going on, but of course the CPU is a huge part of that, and the baseband as well, and everything else. That's really important.
And so that all comes together into this Honor 8, which, like Daniel was saying, people in the US don't really know the Honor name very well. Any interactions that they probably had with Honor have been not so great because they've either imported a phone and had kind of a weird experience there, or they bought like an Honor 5X, or they bought a super low-end Huawei phone that was white-labeled and branded under a prepaid carrier or something. This is a completely different experience. It's very much in this very popular segment of $400, but feels more like a flagship phone, kind of has all the big stuff you're looking for as far as a nice screen, metal and glass build, USB-C, high-end internals with, you know, 4 gigs of RAM and 32 or 64 gigs of storage. It has a lot of that nice stuff, but it's not going to set you back a bunch. Like I said at the top, Daniel has used the phone a lot more than I have, but I'm immediately impressed by it. And the immediate comparison is going to be to the OnePlus 3 because these are really like head-to-head kind of devices. But where do you think, either Alex or Daniel, where do you think that this is going to fit as far as, you know, are people going to jump on this or are they going to be hesitant because they don't really know the name?
So I'll tackle it for Europe first. It's kind of interesting over here because we have Huawei phones as well. And especially in the past 6 to 9 months, we've had the P9 series, which is, I mean, not exactly the same phone, but maybe 90% the same phone.
Yeah, pretty much the same internally.
Yeah, so the P9, the big difference, I think, there in terms of performance and stuff, the P9 has 3 gigs of RAM, this has 4. The P9 Plus also has 4, and that's why that phone is just generally a lot faster and a lot better at multitasking than the regular P9. So it's a good thing that the Honor 8 has that extra gig of RAM. But I think it's going to take a lot for the Honor 8 to not just completely destroy sales of the regular P9 over here, because of course there are some things that you get with the Huawei phone that you don't get with the Honor 8. Like, you get a bunch of extra LTE bands if you travel a lot. Maybe that's a big deal to you. You get the Leica branding and the Leica camera app. You also get the metal build, which maybe, you know, it's kind of a matter of taste at that point, but some people will prefer that brushed metal back. But 90% of the phone is the same, and of course you would expect the Honor 8 to be priced competitively as well. So it's like Huawei is competing with itself, but maybe it's going to...
They would rather steal sales from themselves than have somebody else steal sales from them, I guess.
I don't know. Would they? They're still trying to build out the Huawei brand as its own thing in the UK and in Europe, and they got to this point where they've kind of usurped the likes of HTC and LG this year as the major competitor to Samsung in Europe. Do they really want to be throwing a wrench in the works, introducing Honor and saying, okay, here's the same phone as we already gave you, but it's cheaper, so maybe next time don't buy a P10, wait for the Honor 9, because it'll be, you know,
okay, you
get into all those kinds of arguments. There were worse things to do than to compete with yourself, and it's that I think the P9 is still a solid enough phone. I would definitely recommend picking up the Honor over it, because it's just, you get more of everything, and it's probably going to be cheaper as well, but it's... it's interesting where we are, and where we have these two very similar brands. These two very different brands competing with two similar products, especially in Europe.
Well, I mean, I see this phone. I mean, you talked about LTE bands. Like, the one that I have in my hand it's predominantly focused on the U.S. There aren't that many worldwide bands. This is very much a, you know, built for the U.S. device, and that probably saved them some money. It probably made it cheaper to build because they didn't have to worry about as many antennas. It's a Cat6 device, so it's 300 megabits down, 50 megabits up, but it does support carrier aggregation. But this isn't some Note 7 type device that technically supports Cat12 and has a million different bands and a single SKU for the whole world. So I mean, that's really where they're saving a lot of money there. That's getting into the weeds a little bit, but. I see it a little bit like Samsung throwing out, their A series alongside their S series. This is clearly built on the same hardware. It's the same bones, but they've taken some very specific steps to make it cheaper. And, I see that in a little bit, like Andrew mentioned, that the glass back does feel a little bit plasticky. It doesn't feel quite as premium as, say, the glass back on the Note 7 or the S7. I think that's absolutely right, and I really, now I can't stop focusing on that when I hold the damn phone. Thanks a lot, Andrew.
Yeah, the first thing I grabbed it, and I was like, just running, tapping my fingers on the back of it like that, and I was like, what the heck? Is this glass or what? No, it definitely is glass. It's just not, it's just, but of course this is half the price of a GS7.
It is, yeah. And this is Daniel and Andrew using this thing after a week with a Galaxy Note 7, which costs like $1,000.
Right. That's true. That is very true.
And you're, you don't have, they don't do waterproofing. You don't, it's a 1080p display, which, okay, that's fine. It's just a 1080p display. It's still a nice display. There's no image stabilization on the cameras. It is this, I mean, this is the same kind of thing that we've seen over and over again in the last 2 years in this mid to high range, affordable flagship segment. There are going to be missing things, but the idea is that they hit all the big numbers where you're not missing out on stuff that you would traditionally miss out on a mid-range phone, where it just doesn't make sense to even compare it to a high-end phone before. These definitely do, fingerprint sensor, the higher end stuff.
Sure. So you mentioned the camera before, and that's something it has in common very much with the P9 range, which has the Leica branded camera. Did you get any feel? I mean, did Honor talk to you about what the difference is between the dual camera setup that they have and the Leica camera? Or is it just a case of, well, it's dual camera? We can probably imagine that it's basically the same hardware on the inside, maybe without the software tuning. Is that the impression you get?
It's missing a sticker that says Leica.
Right.
Yeah.
I very much get the impression that this is the exact same dual camera setup. They just couldn't use the name Leica. And as you said, it's not like that Leica name really does anything other than be the name, like it was in the P9.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I haven't used the P9, but I don't think there's any difference technically to this camera over the P9.
It would be silly if there was. They're not going to spend the money to build a completely different camera subsystem for a phone that can use one they're already manufacturing.
And it's, there are enough internal differences already that it probably just is the same thing. Kind of interesting, because of course I forget that you guys haven't actually used any of the P9s, so I'll have to bring both of those up with me to New York when I come for our meetings over the weekend.
Oh, we can use it to hold the door open.
Everybody check out Alex's excellent video of the P9 Plus, which is, it's very insightful. What I'm really interested in as well is why put the P9 out with 3 gigs of RAM and the P9 Plus out with 4, knowing that down the road the Honor 8 would get 4 gigs.
They necessarily knew down the road that it would get 4 gigs. I think that is more of a reaction to the fact that they had 2 SKUs. They deliberately positioned the Plus as the higher end one, so throw in an extra gig of RAM, and maybe in the intervening period they realized that okay, there is this performance gap, and if we want to fiddle around with the bill of materials, maybe we can sneak 4 gigs of RAM into the Honor phone because it's going to make that much difference. That's right. The impression I get anyway.
Hopefully. Why build software that needs 4 gigs of RAM in the first place? Android One phones run fairly well on 1 gig.
Yeah, remember the Nexus 5X only has 2 gigs.
Yep.
And doesn't the Nexus,
on the latest preview, it runs better than the 6P, I'll say it.
Oh, that's bull.
No, it's not. No, it's not. Ask around.
I haven't used my 5X on the preview. I've only used the 6P on the preview.
It's amazing. I don't understand what they did. I can't figure out what they did, but they did it.
Either way, it definitely took them a whole year is absurd.
Yeah, I know. That phone was before, a mess.
Before we get too far into the Nexus train, let's wrap up this Honor thing by, I'll lay out my expectations are that this, it's going to take a while for Honor to get into the US in the way that, they've had a longer run up in Europe. But this is already one that the enthusiasts, the same kind of people that are buying the OnePlus 3 or the ZTE Axon 7 or, probably the Nexus phones are looking at this and be like, hey, this is offering a really nice complete package. But I think it's going to take a few generations of these to get caught up, and I think that the software still has a good ways to go, and I think the Honor knows that the software has a good ways to go, but that doesn't mean that they can just pivot on a dime and make it happen.
What's interesting about the software is in a few weeks in IFA we are most likely going to see the new version of EMUI, which maybe even based on Android 7.0, who knows. So it is a little bit strange to see them doing that. I mean, like, people release phones all the time, of course, in different times of the year, but it's maybe a little bit unfortunate that they weren't able to get in there with the new version straight away. Instead, we'll probably see a Huawei phone running that, running the new version in a couple of weeks. But of course, it's still Huawei behind the scenes. So if you pick up an Honor 8 when it comes out, you will, in maybe 3 to 6 months, get a new version of EMUI, and you'll benefit from all the new software changes and the new notification system and everything else that we'll come to know in this new version of Android and new version of EMUI.
Well, I'm going to ask, because I know people are going to ask me, and I want to see if we can answer them. Does it have the same liberal, go ahead, unlock your bootloader, it doesn't kill your warranty, here, we'll even help you atmosphere that the 5X had?
Even more. I mean, in Europe, even more so. I know.
Yeah, that's a big deal. I mean, that really pits it up well against the OnePlus 3, because I'm trying to say this gently, the OnePlus 3 development community can be a little toxic at times, and I think a lot of people know what I'm talking about. And the Honor 5X, not so much. So, maybe this is one that...
Yeah, there was certainly a huge following there with the 5X. I know with the recent Huawei phones that are based on the Kirin 950 and 955, with the unlocked versions, basically all you do is... you send an email to Huawei and say, give me an unlock token. Here's my IMEI. And they send it back. And
sweet.
That's how you unlock your bootloader. Yeah, same as with any other manufacturer like HTC or Sony might do.
My question is, Jerry, and I mean, this is a bit of a tangent, but back in the day when you would install Cyanogen, some stuff wouldn't work. Like, there would be, even on stable or more stable builds, there would be... you know, problems with the camera or problems yep. with the baseband. Is that still the case today on devices, say like the Honor 5X?
For some devices, yeah, it depends on the manufacturers. That you can't, the Android source code, it's not an operating system. It won't run until you add stuff to it. A lot of that stuff has to come from the manufacturers. Some are less willing to share than others. From my understanding, the 5X is pretty good. You know, it's not Nexus level good, where here's everything, do whatever you want. But Huawei didn't deliberately hold things back. I know there was one case with I do believe it was a camera driver where they said, "It, you know, we'll get it to you, but we need to, a few days. We need to clear some things up." And then a few days later, they delivered. So, and, you know, that's important if you still want to mess with your phone. It's picking the brand is you know, where you should start. And I don't have a particular brand I recommend. I don't. They don't even act the same. You know, Samsung is fine with some of their phones. Other phones, not so much. The same goes for HTC. All of them are the same way.
So while we're talking unlocking and all this stuff and phones that are priced around the $400 level, something we're expecting probably in the next month or two, new Nexuses. Is it worth picking up, if you're that kind of person that likes to unlock, likes to tinker around, likes complete control of his stuff, is it worth buying, say, an Honor 8, a OnePlus 3, even an Axon now? Or are we to the point now where you might as well wait for the Nexus because it's going to be all of those things and so much more?
See, I can't figure that out. To me, no. To me, the best phone, if you want to play with it right now, is still last year's Nexus because it's just easier. But other people, they think differently. Well, it's easier because there's so much more out there for you to try if you're not building it yourself. And if you're building it yourself, it's easier because everything that you need to do it is made freely available and instructions are given on how to do it.
So, right, there are more people out there building cool things to run on your Nexus 6P than there will ever be for an Honor 5.8 or 5.8.
Yeah,
Honor 8.
There are a lot of cool people doing a lot of cool stuff for lots of other phones, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not as easy. If you actually want to dig in and try to do some of this stuff yourself, I wouldn't recommend anything except a Nexus phone. But people are different. They want, maybe they like the way it looks, or they want the dual
camera. Oh, yeah, there's way more to that decision.
Yeah. So it's important that, you know, if you like a phone, but you do want to unlock it and mess with the software on it yourself, you need to know ahead of time if that's going to be difficult or easy.
I think that's a fair point.
Yeah, I would, if you ask me just for a one sentence recommendation, wait for the Nexus.
Okay. Well, I think we've got some more Nexus and Nougat talk to cover. I mean, it's going to be huge in the next 2-3 weeks. But before we get off of too much hardware here, I want to go to the opposite end of the spectrum, because I realized as we were getting ready for this podcast that when we did the last podcast, Daniel and I were both using the Note 7 getting ready to put up my review. And so we weren't going to go to talk about it a whole bunch. But now we can. The review's out. Daniel and I have been using the Note 7 for well over a week now. And so I think we've landed at the same point on this, but I want to know, Daniel, what your thoughts are on it now that you've used it longer and, you know, you didn't have to put together a cohesive thought in terms of a review, but I think you probably have some good feelings on it.
I think it's probably the best Android phone you can buy today. You know, all things considered, the biggest qualms related to the Samsung, the Galaxy S7 Edge, which you conveyed in your review really well, were that it wasn't that usable in one hand. It was very slippery, and the edge was just too steep, and it made actioning some of Android's most like common gestures very difficult.
Like swiping in from one side, like the most basic thing that you need to do in practically every app did not work on the S7 Edge.
Right. I don't think so. I think the Note 7 is prettier than the S7 Edge. and it looks great. I mean, we've seen both the black, the review unit you have. I have the silver one. We saw the coral blue one at the launch event. They're all really nicely made. The symmetry is really, it not only looks better, but it makes it easier to hold in the hand because the curves meet at the same place on the front and back. And it's not obvious when you look at it, but it really does make it easier to grip. And the software is awesome. I think a lot of the tweaking that was really in your face in previous versions of Samsung phones is now hidden a little bit. It's opt-in, and everything that you can do when you just boot up the phone, other than the iris scanner, which I'm sure you'll get to in a minute, works perfectly. The S Pen's really great. The launcher is a lot better, even though they turn on those stupid icon frames. And
the squircles.
And yeah, I think it's a great phone. Every time I pick it up, I'm still amazed at how sharp it is. The fact that you can basically take this outside in the middle of summer at the most bright time of the day and use it is incredible. And the camera is as good as the S7's was, but the camera interface is even better. So overall, I think it's the best Android phone you could buy today. It's just super expensive.
Yeah, I think that we got a lot of comments to this effect in the forums and on the review that, like, you know, on two points, one being, you know, you talked about, you know, it's too big for some people, so not everybody will want it. Well, it's like, yes, that's the case. And while you talked about it being too expensive, yes, that's probably the case. But going into it, you know what the price is. You know roughly what the size is.
Going into it, you know what Samsung wanted to create. They wanted to create an expensive high-end phone for people that is big for people who want an expensive high-end phone that is big. If that's not the phone that you want to buy, then Samsung has a bunch of mid-range phones. It also has a smaller high-end phone that's pretty good.
Right. So there are always going to be categories when we talk about. But I'm totally with Daniel talking, you know, saying that the Note 7 is the best overall phone that you can pick up. That doesn't mean it's the best phone for everyone, and that doesn't mean that everyone is going to pay $900, $1,000 for one. I mean, I know the retail is about $850 depending on the carrier in the US, but, you know, you throw in your taxes and things like that. It's expensive. It's more than most people will pay for their laptop computer or their desktop computer that they use every day. That's kind of crazy, but we know that going in, and yes, it'll go down in pricing over time and you can finance it and all that stuff. But the Note 7 is, some people aren't a big fan of the fact that it doesn't feel as much like a standout Note the same way. I mean, the Note 5 started this trend a little bit, but the Note 4 definitely felt like a completely different class of device. And the Note 7 does not feel like that. It feels like another GS7.
All those people that are making that complaint, come visit me and I'll let you play with my Note 3 and you'll stop. You won't want that anymore.
Exactly. So this doesn't have, there's nothing about the Galaxy Note brand that means that it has to be some outlandish thing with a bunch of crazy trade-offs where it does all this stuff, but it doesn't really make as much sense as a daily use phone or make as much sense for as many people. The Note 7 definitely does feel like it's made for more of a mainstream audience where it's just a little bit bigger than the GS7 Edge, which I think is selling way better than Samsung even expected it to. But like Daniel was saying, this is actually easier to use and feels smaller than the S7 Edge does.
Oh, and that cannot be overstated. It does feel smaller than the S7 Edge. And that's hard because it's not smaller, first of all. But it also
wait a minute. It's smaller in one metric.
yes, the battery capacity.
I see where you're going
has
with
to
this.
Just right, ruin okay. the feel.
I couldn't let that one slide. Sorry.
So exactly.
But
well,
I mean, there's a serious point behind that because there's a reason surely that it feels small, but they can make it so compact is because the battery isn't quite as big, and because of course they need the extra space for the S Pen. So maybe that has something to do with it.
And having a little bit different dimensions means that they could spread out things internally a little differently. Surely pushing those corners further out and making them smaller means there's more, you know, internal space in there. Of course, you had to make room for the S Pen, things like that. But it is just, it's crazy how much easier it is to reach across the phone or use it in one hand than the GS7 Edges, which is smaller and basically the same thickness. And this is just Samsung iterating on this curved screen thing. I mean, they tried it at first with the Note Edge, which is a complete and utter failure that no one will ever want to talk about ever again. And even with the GS6 variant and the GS6 Edge Plus, you know, they still had those usability problems. But this really, somebody asked me this question, I think in the comments or on Twitter or something, you know, this bodes pretty well for the Galaxy S8 or whatever they want to call it, having a curved screen like this.
Yeah, there've already been a bunch of predictions to that effect. And I think it makes you wonder more if they're going to still keep doing two phones early next year. If they do, what is going to be the distinction between them? And is it going to get back to a case of the Edge screen is less prominent and less curvy and that they just go with this Note-style design across three SKUs? And if that's the case, then, you know, what are the screen sizes? You know, how does that play out? It's changing every year. So we went from two smaller Galaxy S phones and a Note and a larger Edge, and now we have a different mix makeup this year, and now it looks like if they're going with the sort of smaller Edge corners with the Galaxy S8 next year, then that's going to be a totally different landscape of devices. So I think nothing is probably off the table just yet as far as that goes.
And I think that you just have to look at this from, you know, a historical perspective, where you see that Samsung will introduce a bunch of new features on various phones, and when one catches on, that all of a sudden becomes a standard feature, where you saw people like the waterproofing and the active phones, then all of a sudden they just started putting it in everything.
The same goes for software features too. I mean, when you
the
Note 7 brings all the features from the original Notes that people actually used, and they've cut out the ones that people don't.
Mm-hmm. And they keep adding a couple little things in the software here and there.
I know a lot of people loved S Note, and it was kind of neat. It did a lot of neat stuff. But Samsung knows what apps you use. You agree to let them, you know, to tell them when you sign in, and not enough people were using it to keep developing it. That's just how this business works.
And of course, that's going to lead to some cohesion between devices, and that's why we see that the Note 7 isn't, you know, physically that much different than the GS7, GS7 Edge. But I don't see that as a problem if they continue to do this thing where they introduce a lot of new stuff as well. I mean, the software on the Note 7 is easily the best form of TouchWiz or whatever they want to call it nowadays that they've done. It's a considerable improvement in usability over what's on the GS7 in terms of simplicity. And like Daniel said, things getting out of the way and new basic features. They still have a lot of bloatware and it's trying to do too much all the time. But that's something where they could have waited for Nougat, or they could have waited for a future release. But they, you know, they've surely been working on this for a long time. And they said, now's the time. And we're just going to trot it out with the Note 7 on top of all the S Pen stuff. So as long as they keep adding new stuff like that, I'm totally okay with, you know, spreading out key features across the line. And that's how you get to the point where you can have the small GS7 and the big Note 7, and they both have the same performance characteristics and the same kind of great hardware and waterproofing, wireless charging, all those kind of table stakes things. And then they, you know, they throw in some extra stuff on the side.
We also have to remember that, you know, this has worked really well for another big smartphone manufacturer.
He went
and
there.
Yes.
You know, it's not going to surprise anybody that, you know, they want to maximize profits. Samsung really has a vested interest in increasing shareholder value.
And there are massive profits to be had on a Note 7 that sells for $900.
Yeah. I mean, the markup on a $900 phone is enormous, but giving people reasons to buy one is increasingly difficult. So, you know, even though the Note 7 may not have a Snapdragon 821 and blah, 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 it does. It's not so much the specs that need to change every year. It's a reason to upgrade. It's a reason to set itself apart from the S7. So there are some, you know, obviously the S Pen is a big selling point, and they're moving the S Pen more towards a mouse that isn't just for writing. And if you haven't watched Mr. Mobile's video yet, do that, because he actually made that point. It's more of a mouse pointer now than it ever was. It does a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, instead of just writing and making notes. So I think they're adding value to the S Pen, but the iris scanner as well is another thing that, even though it doesn't work that well today, they're certainly going to push it as a selling feature.
Right. I mean, I made the comparison in my review that just look at how bad the fingerprint scanners were starting with the Galaxy S5,
exactly,
where everyone kind of jokingly said, you know, you won't get any false positives on the fingerprint scanner, which means you're going to have to swipe your finger on it like 6 times in order to get it to recognize you regularly. And, you know, you look at it today where they have some of the fastest fingerprint sensors available. And the iris scanner is going to be one of those things that I think that they're going to stick with it and they'll try it for a couple more times. And then at that point, if it doesn't work, they won't do it anymore. But I mean, right now, it's not good at all. But they seem like this is one of those standout features that they can market really heavily.
Oh, yeah. 100%. And I mean,
right.
I think at the same time, you know, people scoffed at the idea of a fingerprint sensor back when it debuted on the Atrix in 2011. It disappeared for a couple of years, reappeared. It was still pretty bad. I mean, these are, you know, the first time, even though this isn't the first iris scanner, it's probably the first iris scanner implementation that in earnest is done properly, because it has an infrared and a separate camera. You know, it's the first time that it's done properly, and I think that they'll be able to improve it as they calibrate it. So,
yeah, I think the way I would see this developing in terms of future products isn't necessarily phones, where it's easy enough because of the way you always take your phone out of your pocket, the way with the Samsung phone you naturally reach the home button anyway. I think maybe future Samsung Android tablets, this is going to be maybe a useful way to, okay, it detects when you pick it up, and it's just as fast as using the fingerprint scanner. We've already seen that with some of the Windows Hello stuff on Windows tablets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is, I know a lot of people have picked on just a couple, you know, they picked on a couple things on the Note 7 to, you know, say, how can you say this is the best phone? Because look at how bad the iris scanner is, or the battery is 100 milliamp hour smaller than the GS7 Edge. But those things do not, I think this is the most important thing, that those things do not detract from the overall experience that you see in the Note 7. And like Daniel was saying with some of the software stuff, yes, I don't think that Samsung has the best messaging app ever, and the launcher is still kind of annoying, but none of the missteps are things that you can't, you know, not use or change or, you know, ignore easily. And that's great, because before, there were a lot of Samsung features and things that they did that you couldn't ignore that were just annoying and bad. Kind of like where we're at with Huawei software. There are still some things that are annoying and bad that you can't deal with or change. I don't think the Note 7 has any of those from my perspective.
It has one.
Yes, Jerry.
Android 6.
Boom.
Okay. And are we ready for a segue?
Yeah. So, okay. You can end it right there, because, yes, it's going to be a long time before they get Android 7 on any Samsung phone, but you would think that the Note 7 would lead that charge.
Probably.
And because this is very important, because we're right on the ledge here, Alex, from going over to the Nougat era.
We are, but I think we want to mention something first on Samsung phones, and the Note 7 in particular, getting 7.0. I think executives are making noises about a kind of a 2 to 3 month time frame, which, given that Samsung has probably had 7.0 code for as long, you know, going back way before the public preview, probably not impossible that they already be reasonably far along with that. And Jerry probably will disagree with me. In fact, I know you'll disagree with me, but I think it's entirely likely that even the US carrier versions will have 7.0 comfortably before the end of the year.
And quickly to that point, before you get too deep into 7.0, you wrote something very interesting in which you explained to people, hey, a lot of the stuff that Samsung already put in here is stuff that kind of usurps what you would be expecting from the big release. They did this kind of mid-cycle or late-cycle feature and interface change on Marshmallow, even with Nougat coming with a lot of the same, which would normally carry a lot of those same changes.
Yeah, to a certain extent. And some of it, like multi-window, is stuff that Samsung's had for years and years. Other things like Vulkan API support of things that we've had in Samsung phones since the GS7. So, you're not getting the full feature set, not by a long shot, but there are quite a few important things there. And if you're looking at Nougat as just user-facing features, if you're a normal phone-buying person looking at it that way, then there's a large proportion of that pie that you already get with a Note 7 running 6.01.
All right, so what's our time frame here? What's happening with, we have Nougat coming. We know we're on the developer preview already, so we've seen a lot of stuff. We know that the LG V20 is going to come out before Nexus's probably, but there's going to be this weird middle ground where we have software that comes out before the Nexus devices.
Yeah, so we had a story that went up today. I think it was TELUS, one of the Canadian carriers, had their software update schedule go up with Android N for the 5X and the 6P, supposedly going up Monday, and yep. The 22nd of August, and that just happens to be the same day that LG's preview program for Nougat on the G5 kicks off, just by some amazing coincidence. So, it's almost certainly coming Monday for Nexuses. You would expect, it gets to noon Pacific time, and you're going to have your system images up there ready to flash for your supported Nexus phones. And that is going to mean, because of course LG has straight up said that they're going to be the first shipping with it out of the box. There's not going to be some random Nexus announcement coming Monday. That will come probably a month or so later. And we've already been over a lot of the reasons behind this, where we have probably this extra API level that's going to have maybe some new stuff for pressure-sensitive screens or whatever in it. We're also going to have probably a new layer of Google software just on top of stock Android, especially for these new Nexuses. So even if the basic OS is done by that point, it doesn't necessarily mean that all the Google stuff is, and things like Daydream and Google Assistant are done. But, it means you currently have a Nexus. Then one of the perks of that is you are one of the very first with 7.0. But it also means that maybe when the new Nexus has come out, there are going to be some things that are in that phone that will never come to yours officially. Good news is you got a Nexus, so by the time that happens, someone will already be reverse engineering it and working out how to port it back to the older phones.
Look at you trying to dance to make sure you say the things we're not supposed to say. That's just hilarious.
What? I'm just used to talking about this stuff without getting in trouble. That's fine.
I know it's it's not. We don't know all the details. I'm just giving Alex a hard time. But one thing that I have heard really, really bugs me, and that's if you don't support the features that of this Android 7.0 that's launching, things like having split system partitions, you're not going to be able to get the features in Android 8. They're going to depend on it.
What features might those be?
One thing I heard kicked around that isn't, Android 8 is instant apps.
Well, instant apps is going back to all the way back to KitKat
in some
it?
Capacity.
Yeah,
yeah, but I mean they've got ideas there that are going to require that you actually use Android as written. And nobody does that, and that's a problem. That means that you're going to have Nexus phones that do Android, and then you're going to have other phones that run Android apps. And I don't know that I like that direction.
So here's something that was kicked around. I think Ron from Ars Technica was talking about the idea of the system UI, which is basically, the portion of Android that controls the stuff that you actually see, for want of a better word. That's a terrible way of explaining it. It's things like the way the notification shade looks, the way the basic building blocks of Android appear to you on, say, a Nexus phone versus a Galaxy phone. And there is talk of that in whatever build, you say a 7.0.1, whenever that goes on the Nexuses, of that being split out of the OS and that being a separate thing that lives on the Play Store. And if that happens, then you could easily see with a phone that ships on 7.0.1 after the Nexus, maybe that, you know, maybe if you're building for that as is required on your Galaxy S8 or whatever, then maybe Samsung's system UI will have to live separately. And so if you get a Galaxy S8, you just go download the Google system UI and you have maybe not entirely the Nexus experience, but a large chunk of it there. What do you think of that, Jerry? Am I just crazy?
No, I've heard the same. I don't think the wrench in that works is putting it on the Play Store and making it available for download. It's basically you can use the vendor partition to...
Mm-hmm.
It's, I don't know, if you play video games, you can get packed files and loose files, and the loose files always overwrite what's supposed to be there. Android can kind of be the same way. You stick your loose files in the vendor partition, and when the phone boots, it goes along and does what it needs to do. But if it sees something different in the vendor partition, that's what it does instead of what it normally would do. So I think that's the avenue that, you know, Samsung and LG and Huawei and the rest... That's where they need to put their stuff, and that means that it's still something that you probably can't get from the Play Store.
Hmm. I mean, in an ideal world where that was the case, you kind of have like a two-pronged approach there, where Google's making it easier to work with Android in a way that means you don't have to mess with Android, so all your stuff can live actually in a separate partition that is completely separate from the system. And then you have the UI stuff, which, if it is just packaged off by itself... then the user can go and just do what they want with that. And you might imagine two, 3 years down the line, maybe you have this, like we had this sort of explosion of custom launches back in the day.
Yep.
Maybe you have an explosion of custom Android system UIs later on. Maybe that's even going to be possible at some point.
Yeah, that's entirely possible. I mean, it can be done. I don't see any indication that we're moving in that particular direction. That doesn't mean that it's not happening. Either way, does one very important thing. It keeps the people that make phones out of the base core system, because Google is getting in trouble because these companies aren't filling their commitment to you, and Google's catching the blame. They won't fix it. Samsung is never going to fix it. We praise them for their updates on the three expensive phones they make. The other 44 that they sell new in 2016 aren't getting updates. And that's,
I'll take the over on 44, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, but that's just the facts. It's nothing is changing, and Google is catching all the heat, and you know that's bad for your brand. Even if it's not your fault, it's bad for your brand. So it's on them to fix it. And I think that's what they're trying to do.
Yeah, this is part of the master plan. I think maybe if we don't see it fully crystallized for another year or two.
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going pretty deep down the rabbit hole here.
Right. But my whole point is I'm worried that a phone you bought today, and I'll use the Note 7, a phone you bought today, there's no reason you should be able to buy it. You know, it's Android. So you should expect that the features that get announced on stage next year are going to come to your phone too. And if they're not going to be available because your phone was built in a way that can't run the features from this year, that's a problem.
An interesting thing about the next version of Android next year is, if you look at the Nexus lifecycle, it's probably going to be the first version of Android that requires a 64-bit CPU and all the extra stuff that ARM64 brings. Right.
Right. Yeah. If you bought a 32-bit phone in 2016, you're dead. This is it for you. You're never. Well, it just makes no sense. Jerry, always the
optimist. Your phone will explode.
It makes no sense to keep supporting them. You know, nobody makes new processors that are 32-bit.
The exception there maybe is Android Wear, because I guess to date every single Android Wear watch is 32-bit because they're all still Snap 400s.
Yeah, yeah. I'm fully expecting 64-bit microprocessors to show up when they start showing off new watches.
Yeah, well, they already announced Snapdragon 2100, I think, for watches back in February. I've heard nothing from that yet, and we're probably like 2 weeks away from new Android Wear watches. So, yeah, I fully expect that to be 64-bit.
Yeah, it makes economic sense, and that's why it'll happen. Not because it makes common sense, but there has to be
that clean cut at some point for a lot of these big things. When you're talking about processor architectures or major changes to the way that the Android system works that you can't really update in place, those kind of things, there has to be a cut somewhere. And we have seen a lot of these over the years, and there are always issues with phones that are in long development cycles coming out at inopportune times when we're looking at Android releases coming up. You know, Samsung wasn't just going to push back the launch of the Note 7 by a month and a half or 2 months or 3 months just to be able to do that. You know, then they're pushing into the development of the next Note. So they're on different paths, and it's really annoying, and it sucks to be able to have to put like a qualification on any kind of recommendation by saying, well, we don't know how it's going to work out or what they're going to figure out to sidestep it. The Note 7 and Android 7 is a really good example where the issues are not extremely clear, but the issues are very visible with an upgrade path, right?
Potentially. I mean, I know that anybody who can work on it at Samsung and at Google are going to do everything they can to make sure that the next version, not Android 7 and not, possibly a 7.1, but the next big version of Android will still work on the Note 7. You know that they want that. Whether somebody will give it to you to install or not, I don't know. But they'll want it to actually be able to work. But you kind of nailed it. They want to make big changes, and they need to make big changes. And that means that eventually somewhere there has to be a cutoff point. And I just hope that this year isn't it. I hope we can delay it for another year.
Yep. Do you have any final thoughts here, gentlemen, on what you're ready to see from Nougat or wild shots in the dark about the Nexuses? I know we're going to talk about Nougat a lot, probably on next week's podcast, but we're still a few weeks away from the Nexuses here.
Sorry for the interruption, folks, but I have to tell you about this week's sponsor. It is one of my favorite sponsors. It is one of my favorite companies. It is Harry's. Harry sells razors for less. Guys, you need to shave. You need to look good. And Harry's helps you do that by not upcharging you. They do not want to sell you expensive razors, but they also want to sell you good razors. So when they decided to overhaul their manual razor line, they kept prices exactly the same. That means you still pay $2 per blade compared to about $4 for the average drugstore blade. And the blades you buy from Harry's are great. They are 5-blade razors, and they now include a softer flex hinge for a more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for those hard-to-reach places without making you bleed. They have a lubricating strip and a textured handle for more control when things get wet. Personally, I've been using them for a few weeks. Yes, they sent them to me, but that's okay because I got a shave too. And I have to admit, after using the other guys for a long time, I really like Harry's. I also transitioned away from electric razors back to manual because I like the way these feel. Harry's makes great razors. And if you want to get in on this, all you have to do is go to harrys.com and enter the offer code AC. What do you get for that? Well, you get $5 off their starter pack, which includes a weighted razor handle of your choice, moisturizing shave cream, 3 precision engineered 5-blade cartridges, and a travel cover for $15. That's a limited time offer only available to AC podcast listeners if you go to harrys.com and enter the offer code AC at checkout. Thanks, and back to the show. We'll be right back. I think we know a lot about them. I mean, the leaks have been pretty steady over the last few weeks. We know that they're likely going to be built by HTC, and they will both be metal, and there may be, you know, I think Ron Amadio I'm sorry if this is getting a little bit too inside baseball, but he posted a GIF that compared an off-center version of the HTC 1A9 to the leaked render of the lower-cost HTC Nexus phone. And, I mean, even if that's not true, it makes a lot of sense that, like LG did with the Nexus 5 and, to some extent, the 5X, it reused and slightly modified an existing design to keep costs down. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. If HTC put a Snapdragon 8, whatever they're putting in the lower cost version, I mean, even if it's, I don't know, it's 652?
Yes, it's an 821.
Yeah. In the lower cost.
It almost has to be.
Yeah, in the lower cost one, yeah.
Well, that's great. So then, you know, you get rid of all the criticisms around performance with the 1A9, and, you know, you have a decent quality design. It's a nice phone, so...
Dude. You give me a 1A9 with decent internals, that's the phone I'm using. That was a great little phone when it didn't bog down.
Yeah, well, so I mean, I think it's very tempting to look at a phone that is out there that you can see and look at and buy and tilt to any angle that you want to fill any sort of scenario, and then to look at a grainy, dark image of a phone that we've seen in a handful of leaked charts and say, okay, it's definitely using the same glass panel on the front, and that's bad because HTC just pulled them out of a dumpster or something when they couldn't make any more A9s. I think there's going to be more to it than that. And if you look at, you know, if it is HTC this year, this is a big deal for HTC. You know, with the state their smartphone business is in now, it's a big deal. This is the major partner that they have that is keeping that business afloat, basically. You know, you have the desire phones that are a moneymaker still, the cheaper desire phones. You have the HTC 10, which is selling, but not enough to really move the needle by all indications. And then you have Google partnering with this huge company that, you know, it's making two phones for them this year, it looks like. Is HTC really going to want to be in a position where they're cheaping out on Google and saying, okay, we're just going to use this glass that we had lying around because it's the same shape as this other phone? There's something about that just seems like oversimplified to me.
Well, it always, I mean, that's the case with every leak. It's always oversimplified. But the problem is that we never go back and analyze the leaks once the actual devices have been announced. We never go back and criticize, you know, Evan Blass because he got something wrong. We just expect him to...
To be fair, Evan doesn't normally get things wrong.
No, but I mean, he has gotten things wrong. And I mean, he rarely gets things wrong. And, you know, what's up, Evan? You do great work. But I'm saying, if you have a good track record, nobody's going to go back and say, oh, you messed that up. Or they shouldn't, at least. But we rarely, as an industry, we rarely do. You know, we rarely care about it as long as the phone gets released and it you know, meets our expectations. So in this case, it doesn't really matter. I mean, we're going to find out in a couple weeks anyway. But as Jerry said, if it is a 1A9 with an A21 and, you know, stock Android software, then, you know, a lot of people are going to be very happy.
I think the most interesting thing to me about the back of this thing, the front is, you know, from all the pictures that we've seen, just glass like any other phone, like any other Nexus. The back, supposedly in the couple of images that are leaked out this week and some of the renders that are doing the rounds earlier, it has this very large glass window on the back and a fingerprint scanner on the back.
Yeah, like the top third of the phone.
Yeah, and I think the proportion might be different on some of the pictures that have come out this week of the smaller one. What's interesting for me there is how this is coinciding with Android Pay arriving in a lot of countries, and if you have a larger glass window on the back, that is a much larger target for something like Android Pay, and it's going to make it much easier to use. You know, as we've seen from a lot of the Huawei phones, you don't need a big glass window on the back just for antennas. You can, you know, it's presuming this thing has antenna lines like every other phone. The payment angle to me of having this huge glass area on the back is pretty interesting.
Definitely. I mean, that's been an interest of mine for a long time. And Android Pay has been teased to come to Canada for months now. So I would say it's likely that they'll probably roll it out to, you know, a dozen countries at the same time. because they can. I mean, the infrastructure is there in a lot of places now that wasn't there a couple of years ago when they launched Android Pay.
Yeah, as a quick aside while we're talking about Nexuses, is I've been using Android Pay a lot, even though, I mean, this is kind of a weird thing. I mean, even on my Samsung phones where I have Samsung Pay, because I switch around phones a lot, and of course I don't only use Samsung phones, I just like the consistency of having the exact same experience, having my cards all loaded in there and not having to switch back and forth. And I have, I don't know if I could put like a percentage on it, but a large majority of the places that I go offer Android Pay, Tap and Pay terminals. And it's just been something that's just started to tick up in my usage probably in the last 6 months. And I mean, I don't know. Obviously, there are a lot of other countries that have even more of these payment terminals. So it's kind of crazy that it's been so limited and people in the U.S. aren't really going to use it as much as other countries. But I'm excited by it. I want everybody to be able to use it. And I'm glad that, unlike Google Wallet, they seem to be handling it a little better in terms of universal or near universal use and acceptance.
Yeah. I mean, in a country like Canada where, and the UK and Australia and basically every other country but the US, where where contactless payments are the norm, it just makes sense. You know, I never worry that I don't have my wallet with me anymore, because I take for granted that I can use contactless payments from my phone almost everywhere. So it's fantastic.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, I know a lot of people are saying, oh, well, I just carry my wallet anyway, but I think it's, this is one of those things, hey, it's exciting. If you can use it, really give it a try. It's gotten a lot better since the Google Wallet days.
For sure.
I think that that's a nice random little end to the Nexus Nougat conversation, but we do have a couple more, you know, kind of in that vein. One thing is we've all been making Duo video calls back and forth with,
I hate that,
you know, a very small select number of people, and even smaller and more select with Jerry. It's in the Play Store, and Allo is not yet available, which is,
and I hate that,
kind of interesting.
Worse.
Well, let's talk about hating Duo first. Jerry, what's your issue?
I'm gonna call you a regular phone call, and then I'm gonna have Dan send you a Duo message, and you will see my issue. I talk on the phone a lot, and my goofy friends and my goofy coworkers, all of a sudden my phone makes that obnoxious sound, and there's their monkey face making faces at me while I'm trying to talk on the phone and do some business. And I can't see any way to make it stop. So that's something they need to address. And then maybe I'll like it a little more.
Yes. I mean, so that's a... that's the thing where I feel like that's going to wear off after, yeah. You know, we get down to a normal usability rate, just like, you know, as soon as FaceTime came out, everybody's, oh, you make FaceTime calls all the time. And then now we're down to a regular amount of usage. I think that the important thing here about Duo is it is easy to make. So you're going to get a lot of people on board, I think, that didn't want to deal with how clumsy it was to make video calls, you know, these, you know, carrier specific video calls that are built into the dialers of some phones, or I mean, even Hangouts was slow and kind of funky. Now this is just like a very simple, streamlined thing tied to your phone number. You just pull open your contacts and you call them on Duo. I think it's interesting. You know, am I going to continue to do it all the time? You know, probably not.
You know what? I'll use it to talk to my kids. It's, the app is wonderfully done. It needs some polish. It needs a way to know when the phone's in use, and so it shuts up. But sure. If my mom's next phone is an Android, I'll send her a link to install it, and she'll send me a text back, what's this? And I'll just call her when she's done and tell her, all you have to do is click on my face, and you can talk to me and see me. That's great. That's something we just didn't have.
Yeah, and I mean, for all of the, I mean, the people that are generally, the people that are annoyed by Duo being separate from Allo or anything else are the same people that don't think that there's a problem with Hangouts right now. in that they're happy to have it do as many things as possible. And that means that it's bad and really, you know, there's a lot of cruft everywhere.
I was thinking
about
that.
And now that's not to say, yeah.
Your dialer will be the new Hangouts. When all of this stuff rolls out, you know, there be Allo for IM or secure messaging. You'll have Messenger for SMS and MMS, Duo for video calls, and then your regular dialer for regular phone calls. It will all be integrated into your dialer and your contacts app. Hangouts didn't really go away in spirit. It's still going to live on in a different app. The same features are there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's tough to see the whole situation right now when we don't know, you know, we don't know when Allo is finally coming out and we don't know what the transition period on Hangouts is going to be. But we do know that the current state is that Hangouts has tried to do too much and it kind of did different things for different people, but you couldn't get rid of the other parts that you didn't want to use. So Duo is a nice example of that, where the proportion of people who are going to be using Allo for these group chats and these, you know, secure messaging and all that kind of stuff, and the group that are going to make video calls is a very, very small subsection of those people. And I think that it's a fine experience to have a separate app for that, simply because you just kind of have so many people that don't want to have that capability built in and getting in their way when they're trying to use their Allo messages.
This had to happen. Google had to do this. They had no choice. And maybe this isn't you. You're listening and you're saying, well, that Jerry guy's crazy. People want FaceTime. They want something that involves nothing more than clicking a picture of somebody and then they can talk to them in one way, you know, with a video call. People
but
want
one of the reasons why FaceTime and iMessage works so well is because it's all basically part of the same thing on an iPhone. It's contained with the messaging app, and whether it's SMS, whether it's iMessage, or whether it's a Hangouts call, sure, you have hooks into that in different places, but it still basically all lives in the same area. Whereas on Android right now, you have this mess of different apps that are supposed to do the same thing, and especially when you bring Hangouts and Google Messenger into the picture.
Well, I mean, that's where the dialer comes in. They all live there.
But not every phone has the same dialer.
Right, but I do think that we'll see changes to the dialer app, and it'll go in the Play Store, and they'll improve the UI to give you the experience you want because the capability is there.
Right, but I mean, Alex brings up an interesting point. Allo and Duo can live as independent apps and do fairly well, but one of the benefits of the Apple ecosystem is that you have no choice. FaceTime is there, and it's built into the dialer, and it's the same on every phone, and FaceTime audio is the same on every phone. But you know, what's to say that Samsung doesn't want to do its own Duo and integrate that into the dialer and make it so that only Samsung phones get to talk to one another through the dialer for free? I mean, this was what Volte was trying to solve. You know, voice over LTE brings a video protocol and allows you to make video calls for free or using your minutes over cellular at high, you know, in high quality, similar to the way that you can make Skype calls or VoIP calls over the dialer. And that's really the solution, I think, that's going to work for everybody, because it's platform independent, you know? It's something that you don't have to configure. If you want to make a video call, I go into my my Galaxy S7 Edge, I press video call, and if the other person I'm calling has VoLTE, then it'll just connect that way. It'll connect either over audio or video. It's the openness of SMS, but, you know, built into your dialer.
Every American is just shaking their fist at you. That'll never happen here.
It's true.
Yeah, that's not going to happen here because like I said, each carrier has done its own way of doing that. I mean, that is that's a great example there of something that it's going to happen, and it can absolutely, the groundwork is all there, and it's just not going to happen. And the easier way for Google to do this is not wait for that, but just to put Duo in the Play Store and Apple App Store and see what kind of adoption they can get and get people to get on it. And of course, there's that extra friction of having to install the Duo app, but there's not the friction of having to wait like 4 years for carriers to get on board with the universal video calling.
And only buying the specific phones they supported on that have their names on the back.
But then there is still the adoption thing, and it's like if FaceTime is iPhone only, but if they have to chase that market, that is a market that is already used to making FaceTime calls among themselves. So
yeah,
right. There's a reason why the third party.
But, go ahead, Jerry. But the answer to that is, you know, more than 8 out of 10 phones run Android. Period. We see a lot of iPhones here in the States. Alex, I don't know what the situation is particularly, you know, like where you live, but we forget that Apple, they're huge on the business end. They make giant amounts of stacks of money every year. They probably swim in it like Scrooge McDuck. But as far as the industry goes, their hold on the industry, they're insignificant.
They're absolutely not insignificant. They have an outsized influence on every other smartphone manufacturer. Whether they have the market share or the user base is one thing, but their influence on every single Android manufacturer is still significant. So,
yeah, I mean, why do you think that Duo is
not
coming out?
I meant at all. I meant it doesn't matter what Apple does on their phones because most people will never have it.
But it does matter because that's what people aspire to have, and that's the feature, like individual features. Like people know FaceTime. FaceTime is turned into like Kleenex or Band-Aid for video calls on your phones. I mean, people refer to making a video call as FaceTiming. That's just kind of the thing. And there's a reason why Google made Duo. It's not because they were afraid of people downloading the Skype app on their phone and making video conference calls, because that's kludgy and terrible, just like Hangouts was. They made Duo because they want to compete with, well, FaceTime, but also, you know, some of the other extremely popular chat and group chat apps that are starting to do video as well. I mean, even though we don't know metrics, obviously, for FaceTime users, but yes, there are more people using whatever chat app or something like Skype to make video calls, but that doesn't mean that people don't think of FaceTime as the video calling solution on phones. And that's what they're fighting with, wrong or right.
They're fighting with the public perception. Not saying it right. That's how I started, is that people want FaceTime. Apple refuses to give it to you because the only way they want you to have FaceTime is if you give them $900 for a new iPhone. That makes sense. They're a hardware company.
They're okay with that. Obviously.
That's genius. But people want it, and people aren't going to buy $900 iPhones. They're just not. So Google has to do something. They have to deliver something that's just dead simple, easy. And that's what it is.
And so Duo is, and the quality seems pretty good. It seems to handle mobile networks just fine. And of course, it has all the inherent issues of, like Jerry said, you just have some random person, random at the moment person calling you, and now all of a sudden you've got to make a video call, and that's just inherent no matter how you're doing the video call.
And that'll change. They can tweak the UI. You know, this is just Jerry complaining.
Well, but I mean, just in general, like video calls, there's more of a friction to them than just a regular audio call. Or, hey, people don't really make as many phone calls as they used to. They prefer to just type into WhatsApp or Facebook Messenger or Hangouts or just plain old SMS even, you know, still. And so Google is trying its best to remove as much friction as possible, leaving just that bare amount of friction that's inherent in every video call. And I don't know how well it's going to work. I'm going to keep Duo installed, and I'm going to keep opening it and seeing how many of my contacts it lists as being on Duo. And we'll see how that changes over the next couple months. I don't think that it's going to hit the point where I have even a majority of my contacts have Duo installed, let alone using it regularly.
That's broken too. The only one that shows up on my list is Phil. I have to physically go look for somebody and check and see if they have it in my address book.
They have to also remember just how much of a horrible, terrible rat's nest everybody's contact sheets are. And there are issues with having, you know, your phone numbers formatted incorrectly. And oh my goodness.
I mean, it's the same problem that WhatsApp has been trying to solve for 5 years, but WhatsApp has a 5-year head start.
Yep.
So
yeah, I just
want to give you an example. First of all, WhatsApp doesn't have video calls yet, but they're rumored to be coming out with them soon. But when you search for FaceTime in the Play Store, there are, four or five dozen, apps that come up. The first one that really means anything to anybody is Skype. And then there's, Tango and Viber and Uvo and Kik.
I remember those.
And Imo and TextNow and Facebook Messenger. I mean,
and they've got millions of downloads.
And WeChat. And then there's Google Duo down in the middle. And what's interesting to me is that all of these do what Duo does. All of them. Duo has no advantages right now other than the fact that it's simple and it eschews almost every other feature. It gets rid of all the complexity. All you need is a phone number and somebody's contact list and it'll work. But that, I think, as Jerry said earlier, is what makes it so compelling. It's so easy and so good. It works on 2G speeds. I mean, this is, this is Jerry's point again. This is the FaceTime for people in the middle of nowhere who only have a 2G connection who want to connect to one another using video.
I should have had you explain it in the first place because I made a horrible mess of it. But yes, that's exactly. India wants FaceTime. I'll be blunt. India wants FaceTime. India now has FaceTime.
There you go.
Fair. And obviously, we'll revisit this as we actually use the darn thing because we're basically just calling each other at this point because nobody really has Duo. So that's, not all that useful. But I want to know, obviously we have a more engaged group of readers and listeners who are going to, actually be trying this and get their, get their significant others and their friends and family to try to use it, just like they probably browbeat them into trying to use Hangouts, over the last couple of years. But unless you guys have any final thoughts on Duo, I want to hit a couple quick Q&As and wrap up this this marathon we're working on.
Let's do it.
All right. I put out a little call with a awesome GIF on Twitter asking for some Q&A. I don't know if you guys have looked through this list, but I'm just going to pick out a couple. And let's see here. So, general question from Victor. He says, do you think Android phones, just as a whole, will just move away from the headphone jack like Apple is expected to with the iPhone 7? I know we have a couple random phones that have done that, but what do you think about the industry as a whole?
Probably.
I think maybe in the high-end section. What do you think overall?
It saves money. You don't have to buy the jack itself. You don't have to use as much material to make the phone because it's thinner. And don't fool yourself. Thinner phones are cheaper to make after you've spent the money to engineer them. And companies like things that are cheaper to make. And it's just one less thing they have to fool with. There are other options, so they can freely take it out, and I think they will. And I hate it.
I think it could go one or two ways. I mean, it's going to take a long time for it to go away completely in phones. Let's remember just how old this connector actually is.
Right. I
think it'll be
tomorrow.
Around in some way, shape, or form. But I think it is most likely to disappear at the high end first. I also think there's possibility for it to kind of live on as this sort of specialist thing that is maybe in your notes or your V20 class mm-hmm. phones, ones that are more aimed at people who are either, professional content creators, because of course it's easier to, easy to plug into anything with the right adapter, but less messing around if you're plugging a microphone in, if you can just plug it straight into a 3.5mm jack. So maybe that's the kind of space it'll live on in. But I think at least in the medium term, you're looking at a similar kind of situation that we're facing right now with micro USB, where the mid-range stuff, to a certain extent, and certainly all of the low-end stuff still has micro USB because it's the standard, it's what everyone has. And so, your Moto Gs are still going to be sticking around with maybe with micro USB, we'll see, certainly with a headphone jack and, maybe with things like FM radio as well to play into that. So, it'll take a while. I doubt if we're probably looking at a decade or more away before it goes away in any kind of real tangible way in the industry at large.
All right, put a bow on that one.
Yep.
Pablo wants to know, what makes a charger and a cable capable of doing a Nexus fast charging? He says for the Nexus 6P. This is maybe Jerry, really quick.
Magic.
Yeah. There's a standard that it's a group called the IEEE. It's a highly respected professors and electrical engineers. They defined a standard that the circuitry needs to put out voltage and amperage in a certain way, and the phone that receives it has to do this certain thing when it gets it. Your phone follows that standard. You just need to make sure that the charger follows the standard. The cable, ideally, you want a cable with a resistor in it and not a setup where a charger has the resistor and you can use any cable. And a cable of the correct size and not too long. It's not so that difficult. It's just not real profitable to make a whole new kind of charger and cable just yet.
Sure. For example, in the Nexus 6P, like he's asking about, a lot of time and money is spent on hitting the wider range of quick charge 2.0 and 3.0 chargers. So accessory makers aren't as interested in making stuff that does 5 volt, 3 amp, right. Rapid charging for Nexuses. But there are some out there. There are battery packs. There are wall chargers. They're, of course, just, yeah. So they'll usually explicitly say, because it's something special that they have to choose to do. It's not a standard 5 volt, 2.1 amp charger. So if they made it 5 volt, 3 amp, and it's good for Nexuses, they're usually going to advertise that fact. Let's see. Let's grab two more. How about that? Let's see if we can give quick thoughts on, are there any thoughts on the, this is Mateo, I believe you pronounce it that way. Any thoughts on the quote, "Are tablets dead," unquote, thread?
Yes.
Quick answers.
Tablets are dead. Even an iPad Pro isn't selling like as expected.
Right. I was going to say that this could be greater than the Android ecosystem, of course.
Okay. So the longer slash not too long answer is that tablets are always going to be something people want, but I think that they've plateaued. So we figured out where they live in the phone, tablet, laptop hierarchy, and whereas companies were pushing tablets as this laptop replacement, in the last few years, and I think Google got in that train as well with the Nexus 9 and the Pixel C. I think They're realizing that there isn't a huge market for it, and they're going to continue to be niche products. They're still great, and they still work for a lot of people, but I don't think sales will ever be as high as they once were.
Yeah,
I agree. And it's in Android in particular, I think it's going to be, if there is a solution to, the Android tablet problem right now, which is that they've just been kind of poorly defined and that Android hasn't really, despite Google's best efforts, hasn't really worked particularly well as a tablet OS. I think the solution there eventually will be kind of some kind of midpoint between where Android tablets are now on Nougat and what we have on Chromebooks with windowed mode, freeform mode, and that kind of thing. Whether that's Android or whether that's Chrome OS, we'll have to wait and see. Whether that distinction is even has any meaning by then, I don't know. But it'll be somewhere between the two, and given that the real movement right now is in the Windows tablet space, maybe it'll be more in the Chrome direction.
The best Android tablet you can buy today is an Asus Flip.
I was going to say 2013 Nexus 7, but okay.
Well...
Depends on the needs there. Mm. But okay, let's wrap it up with a very quick one, lightning round from Paul. He wants to know, I think I know the answer to this for everybody. Do you guys use screen protectors? If so, which ones? And what voodoo do you employ to keep dust from getting underneath those things?
So the only way to avoid dust getting on there is basically practice and buying a bunch of screen protectors. So with the tempered glass ones, it's less noticeable when there's dust on there. But there's kind of an art to applying them, and the only way to learn that art is just to buy a bunch of them. There's no easy answer there. I think this is something Apple was looking at a long time ago, where they actually had special machines set up in store to fit screen protectors to iPads, to iPhones, and that's something they were looking at. I get that's something probably only they can do with the retail footprint that they have. Maybe it's something Samsung could look at getting into at some point. But the only real answer there is practice. I'm not using screen protector on any phones that I'm currently using. You know, the totally legitimate reasons to use them. But yeah, it's definitely worth it if you can get that perfect fit and there's no dust under it and you feel really great because your screen's going to last a long time. But it is tricky and there is a certain amount of cost associated with it.
You nailed it for me. Yep. How about you, Jerry?
I don't use them. I just don't. I don't keep a phone long enough to need one. Well, I mean, you know, that's just part of our job. But as far as getting one on without the dust, in Winchester, Virginia, there's this lovely young lady named Nicole that works at Best Buy. Drive to her and give her your phone and buy a screen protector because she can put them on. I mean, I've watched her because I've had to put them on for a couple things, for some pictures and stuff. And what she does is she has an area on her desk and she has a little photography tent. And she unfolds the tent. She puts it in there. She, you know, cleans off the screen with the alcohol wipes. And she lines it up and gets it right the first shot. And when she hands it to you, there is no dust under it. There may be magic in that tent or elves, but that's what she does.
Yeah, you can usually find somebody at one of those, you know, like accessory stores. Yep. Or at like a phone repair little shop that are all over the place. They have put on hundreds and hundreds of these things, and they can usually, they do it if you buy the screen protector from them.
They have their own methods and the stuff laying around to just whip it out and do it right.
Yeah, yep. The only thing I'd add to that is, it seems like a ripoff to pay $25 for a really, you know, so-called high quality screen protector, but it's not a ripoff. There are clear differences in quality between the ones that you get thrown in with a case. And I'm not talking about tempered screen protectors. I'm talking about the plastic ones, the 3M ones that, you know, they do a really good job and they white label a bunch of them. But if, you know, Zag and those companies that charge $25, $30, if you really want this on your phone and you want it to stay for more than a couple months, get the more expensive ones. It's worth it. And then as Jerry said, go to, you know, Nicole in Virginia and have her install it.
She's good at it. It impressed me enough that I needed to talk about it. So I doubt she's listening, but if you are, hi, Nicole. You did a really good job putting that screen protector on.
Oh, man.
All right, and that's as good a time as any to wrap it up. And since Jerry was already going, Jerry, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
I'm on Twitter. I am. I don't do a lot. I've been busy, but it's at.
I'm glad that you're on Twitter more
at
now.
GB Hill, and I do a lot of private communications on Google Plus still, and that's just plus Jerry Hildenbrand, and I write words and put up pictures at this place called androidcentral.com, and we'll be doing more on crackberry.com. So what? If you're an old BlackBerry nerd or a new BlackBerry nerd, we're going to get together.
Alrighty. Not featured on crackberry.com will be Alex Dobie, but you can find him in these places instead.
You can. You cannot find me at crackberry.com, but you can find me at Alex Dobie on most, if not all, of the things. Mostly on Twitter, I guess. Instagram, to a certain extent. And yeah, I guess not related to me personally, but look out for... I guess we want to be bringing up a lot of event pictures and stuff. We have a lot of events going on between now and early September. We've got... we'll have an AC team meetup in New York next week, so I guess we'll have a bunch of pictures of our ugly faces on there. I have the Honor 8 launch in Europe, which will be in Paris, so we'll definitely be sticking a load of like random pictures and video from that on our Instagram story. And after that, just a few days after that, in fact, we have IFA in Germany, and loads of good stuff coming there. So yeah, definitely watch at Android Central on Instagram for all that stuff.
Yes, so much happening, including
LGB20 as well. The week after that, it's going to be busy.
Oh, which Daniel will be at, I believe. So
as of
Daniel,
today,
if people want to follow all of your stuff,
I am confirmed. I have my plane ticket in progress, September 6th. But before then, you can find me on Twitter and Instagram and Snapchat at JourneyDan, Journeyman with a D. And I'm really excited about the next few weeks. It's going to be super busy, not a lot of sleep, but lots of great products. So follow us if you aren't already at Android Central, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Mobile Nations on Snapchat, because we sometimes use that too.
Yes. I've mostly just been trying to crank up the Instagram and Twitter action on the AC accounts. And
I mean, so, this is a little,
it's awesome.
This is a little bit inside baseball, but for people like us who have, you have multiple people on one account, Instagram stories is so much easier to use than Snapchat. It's not even funny.
Yes. And yeah, the multi-account usage and multiple people on one account usage on Instagram is, I'd give it a solid B+. We'll be back with the Android Central podcast next Friday, and that's going to be awesome too. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening, and thank you to these nice gentlemen for joining me on the show today.